the general rule is that whenever we leave space for mammals, they come back. Except that there have been also a few drawbacks. The common hamster, for example. The name says everything, but it's now critically endangered. It ranges from Germany to China, but within this range, populations have almost completely disappeared.
Welcome to Inside Biodiversity. This podcast is hosted by IDIF, the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research. My name is Volker Hahn. I'm head of the Impact Unit at IDIF. And my guest today is Carlo Rondanini. Carlo is a professor of zoology at Sapienza University of Rome. His work focuses on global biodiversity assessment, mammal conservation, extinction risk analysis, and the effects of land use change and climate change on wildlife. Carlo coordinates the Global Mammal Assessment. He has contributed his expertise to IPBES, and he serves on the IUCN Red List Committee. Enjoy this conversation with Carlo Rondanini. Let's talk about mammals. Why do you study mammals? What got you into choosing mammals as your main object of your studies?
So when I was a kid, I actually liked to listen to a radio program on ethology by an Italian ethologist who was called Danilo Mainardi. But that was all about bugs. So that where my interest in ecology, in ethology started. Mm-hmm. And then childhood and and life during my secondary school. And then when I decided to start a bachelor in biology, I met up a very influential professor, Professor Luigi Boitani, who was a wonderful zoologist and conservation biologist. And there I really found what I wanted to work on, and especially on mammals and especially on conservation, because conservation is something that I found useful. So that's what brought me here.
Is there a specific mammal species that you like best, that is your a favorite?
So I have so many species that I like, like lemurs and marsupials from Oceania. But really, the one that I worked with and found very intriguing, although it is very common and everyone knows it in Europe, is the European hedgehog that I studied in the UK. And I like it because it is one of the few mammals that are completely non-territorial. They're non-aggressive to each other. They have this very open mating system. So it's an incredibly peaceful animal. Unfortunately, it's apparently now declining Europe-wide for slightly unknown reasons.
Okay, yeah, we'll talk about a few species today that are both declining, as the hedgehog, but also some that are increasing. And the hedgehog lives in Europe and will start in Europe as well. And there are a couple of species that have expanded in Europe over the last decades, when we think of the wolf or the lynx or the beaver. And another carnivore that has expanded its territory into Europe is the golden jackal. Can you tell us a little bit about what is happening here? Why did, for instance, the golden jackal, why does it expand into Europe? And is this a larger phenomenon, or are the cases that I mentioned, are they exceptions, or are they the rule?
So, well, there is never a rule in conservation, and certainly there is never a rule with mammals, but there is a big trend in Europe and in North America as well, and in other parts of the developed countries. That is the abandonment of agropastoralism. And this means abandonment of rural areas, of mountain areas, return of forests that are naturally returning in many places across Europe. And with forests come the herbivores, the wild boars and deers and many other herbivores. And with the herbivores also come the carnivores. So the wolf has been first from Italy, spread all across Europe. But the jackal is the last amazing expansion of a large carnivore that we're witnessing. was confined to the Balkans in the 60s, basically, and because of hunting and persecution and intensive use of the countryside. Now, without with more and more people living in the countryside, the jackal has first reestablished a little bit from the Balkans. It's reestablished in the 80s, a small population that also came on the verge of Italy, on the very far east. And then at some point, the population has just exploded. In the last few years, they have been expanding all the way to Finland, north, Spain, west, Italy south. Even in Italy, we are camera trapping year after year and seeing more and more jackals coming. So it's one indicator, just one species, but it's a process that is actually applying to so many.
The jackal, the golden jackal, is a species that's expanding into Europe, and some others that I have mentioned are making a comeback. Is that a bigger trend? Are there more mammal species expanding in Europe than decreasing?
Yeah, that is probably the case for Europe overall. We have some of them are conservation successes, like the Iberian lynx, that was a target of specific conservation actions, reintroductions, management of rabbits that are the most important prey for that species. And others have been re-expanding in Europe for a variety of reasons, like beavers that have been reintroduced somehow officially, somehow unofficially in different countries, but certainly are expanding. We had otters expanding, for example, and I know well the situation of the otter in Italy. And it was almost extirpated when I was at the university and when I finished my university. And it came back from a small population in southern Italy, probably because of a slightly different reason from the others, but again linked to a reduction of pressures that was brought by European regulations on river quality, water quality, reduction of pollutants, and they naturally re-expanded. So let's say that the general rule is that whenever we leave space for mammals, they come back. Except that there have been also a few drawbacks. I mentioned the European hedgehog, but it's not the only one. There are others. The common hamster, for example. The name says everything, but it's now critically endangered. It ranges from Germany to China, but within this range, populations have almost completely disappeared.
Yeah, it's a complex picture, but there are some good news, at least in Europe. Let's take a step back and look at the situation on the globe, because obviously Europe is just a small part of the globe. If you had to describe the status of mammals on the globe, how would you describe it?
So we have one quarter of the mammals globally that are at risk of extinction, and the proportion increases slightly at every reassessment that we do. So this is overall not a good situation at all. And we have very clear north-south, or even better, temperate to tropical trends, or differences in trends, because populations tend to be stable or recovering in temperate cold areas and still declining fast in tropical areas. And this is basically, this means is reforestation and renaturalization that we are witnessing in Europe and then North America and Canada, etc. Improvements in China in nature. But this is at the expense of extraction of resources from developing countries, basically. So we are increasing our impacts on the tropics. So that's why we see this nice picture locally, let's say, if Europe is local. But it's not an overall trend.
And are the pressures different for Europe, you said that it's decreasing pressures from hunting, decreasing pressures from agriculture, conservation successes. What would be the drivers in the tropics? Are they different, or are they just the same drivers but just going the other direction?
The drivers are the same. The most important driver remains conversion of forests and other natural land to agriculture to sustain an increasing human population and a human population that has an increasing per capita consumption. So that remains the most important threat for most species. For some of the mammals, the drivers are also related to overexploitation. And this is partly for food again, like in bushmeat in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia and other regions of the world, and partly for more specific needs linked to trade, like Chinese traditional medicine, still a lot of illegal trade of trophies and more direct threats like this one.
Mm-hmm. The trends are more worrying in the tropics. Can we also make distinctions between what type of animals are mostly threatened? We hear a lot that it's the large mammals that are threatened more than the small mammals. Or are there other broader categories? What mammals are threatened more than others, apart from tropics versus temperate regions?
The picture is, again, as always, heterogeneous. Large mammals, it is true, are generally more threatened than small mammals. And the reason is related to several factors all concurring in the same direction. First one is that, of course, large mammals need more space. And conserving species that need more space, like, for example, the African megafauna, or even in Europe, the brown bear, for example, is always more difficult. The second one is that these species have life history traits that make them particularly slow in recovering if populations are impacted by a threat. So while for small mammals, think of small rodents, for example, it is very quick, very fast to have a comeback after a population reduction. They reproduce several times per year. They start reproducing very young, many young per female. For the large mammals, it's the opposite. So this is a clear trend. But then besides that, there are also specific situations that impact relatively smaller species. Think, for example, of all the lemurs in Madagascar. Lemurs are impacted by deforestation in a place that has been already was largely deforested in the 1950s, with forests remaining on the mountain ranges on the east coast of Madagascar. And these are still deforested to the point that almost no forests left. So these are declining fast. Think of the pangolins. There are 8 species of pangolins, and they are all threatened with extinction and in very high categories of risk because of the use of their scales in Chinese medicine. And now, only recently, China has taken measures and removed the scales from the official pharmacopoeia of China, and hopefully this will have an impact. Think of the great apes. All 7 great apes, except us, are either endangered or critically endangered. They are large animals, true, but they are, again, threatened by either direct persecution or, as for the orangutans in Southeast Asia, by conversion of forests to plantations. So, yes, we see trends, but the situation is always region-dependent, and the threats can be regionally different, and different groups of species are threatened in different places.
Yeah. Historically speaking, many of the extinctions that have been documented among mammals happened on islands. Is that the same reason that, you know, the area available is limited on islands as compared to the mainland? Is that the reason why we have so many, or we had, I don't know if we still have, but we used to have many extinctions on islands?
Yes, that is certainly one of the most important reasons. It's not the only one. Another important one is that in many cases, species on islands were completely unprepared to humans and completely unprepared to the invasive species that were brought by humans on the ships, like rats, cats, and other important invasives. So they didn't evolve the capacity to respond and survive to this new alien threat. Another one is related and again, this brings more complexity to the picture. Other reasons are related to the shape of the island, the heterogeneity of the geography. So there are islands that are just flat and small and completely amenable to agriculture, and it is very easy to extirpate species from those islands. There are other islands that are volcanic with higher elevation ranges and mountain areas that are unreachable, so those islands do better. The point is that we have seen many extinctions in the islands in the last, say, 500 years. But now we are starting to see the extinctions on land. Now that apparently, of course, there is no formal analysis of this, but my take of this is that once we brought to extinction the species that were easier to bring to extinction on islands, we have started to expand our impact on land to the extent that the land is an island at this point. I mean, that the impact of humans is so pervasive that even a large expanse of area acts as an island in terms of response of the other species, and we're starting to witness the extinctions on land as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it's remarkable that if you go back a few thousand years, and when there were very few humans on the planet, we already had quite a few extinction events driven by humans. So even a small population already had this large impact on biodiversity and on mammal species. If you take this more historic view on what's happening, where's the trend going? Well, you already said it's more like shifting from the islands to the mainland, but in terms of number of extinctions or the number of species threatened, is it increasing or decreasing, or do we even know that?
Well, we have two bits of evidence. One is a comparison between the historical extinctions since 1500s, more or less, and the background rates of extinction from known periods outside of the mass extinction events. And for mammals, we have around 2% species extinct in the last 500 years, while based on the fossil records and the rate of extinction in the fossil records, the best estimate would be that we should expect 0.2, so at least 10 times higher than what one would expect from natural extinctions. The other bit of evidence is not from extinctions themselves, but from change in risk of extinction. And we have data for mammals, we have data for the last 30 years, more or less, since 1996 to 2008, so a very short time period. But we see, let's say the rule is that for every 10 species that approach extinction, there is one that gets farther from extinction and recovers. And overall, out of 6,000 mammals, there have been more or less 500 species that have approached extinction in these 30 years. So they're not extinct yet. Some of them may be very close, but they are sliding overall towards extinction.
So the number of mammal species that are threatened with extinction is increasing. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
When you compare mammals to other species groups, like birds, fishes, insects, how do they compare? Are they doing better, worse?
So mammals are, in this sense, are probably close, a little above the global average. And this global average is is made, of course, of very different situations. birds.
Sorry, Carlo. You mean above in the sense of more threatened or less threatened?
More threatened.
Okay.
More threatened, slightly more. Birds are typically overall less threatened with extinction than the other groups, and I can only imagine the possible reasons for these. Certainly, birds are more mobile, so they suffer less fragmentation of habitats, barriers, can more easily find refuge than other species. And because they're more mobile, they have much larger distributions, about 10 times larger than the average mammal. So that means that there might be part of the range where the species is less threatened and persists. And maybe there has also been more action, earlier action on birds that is being catalyzed. If you think of Europe, for example, the European Birds Directive has been the first nature legislation, conservation legislation in Europe, and the Habitats Directive that also includes mammals has followed. There are other groups that do a lot worse. Amphibians are the big crisis globally. 43% of the amphibian species are at risk of extinction. And there are more than 100 species that are officially classified critically endangered, possibly extinct, because there hasn't been yet the proof of the extinction, but most of those species might be actually already extinct. And this also depends on a variety of reasons. So amphibians, again, have a, in this case, much smaller distribution. It is 1/10 of the distribution of a mammal. They are linked to a very specific habitat because they're linked to water for parts of their life cycle. They have an unfortunately permeable skin, that means that they're sensitive to pollution a lot more than the others. They have this chytridiomycosis that is wiping out populations of for many of the species. So there are many, many problems that converge together for this extinction crisis for amphibians. For other groups, we don't even know. You mentioned fish. We know something for the freshwater ones because there are not so many species. For marine species, we have an idea for some of them, but there is a lot of data deficiency in the seas because it is a lot more complicated to collect information. And for the insects, for example, on land, it's even worse when we have huge taxonomic problems and we still know very little of the distributions, let alone the trends. So it's very difficult. There are indications of large declines of insects in some parts of the world, but really it is still very hard to get a global picture like we have for the vertebrates.
I recently came across a number that I found quite astonishing, that if you look at the biomass of mammals worldwide, the global share of wild mammals is only 5%, meaning that 95% of global biomass is humans and livestock and pets. And I also found another estimate that says wild biomass is estimated to have declined since the rise of humans by 85%. So huge declines when we look at biomass. And what I find interesting is that we don't see it in species extinctions. You mentioned that less than 2% of mammal species have been extirpated since 1500. We already talked about that it's a complex picture, but having such different stories that you see when you look at different metrics, like biomass on the one hand, maybe population sizes, and then species that have become globally extinct, less than 2%. What does that tell us? How do we make sense of that?
This is an important technical question. We see the same, for example, in the seas, and we know very well that in the seas, many of the species will likely not go extinct at all in the near future, but have been so depleted that fishermen don't go for those species anymore. Usually the shape of the decline of species in terms of population size is not linear, but it's a negative exponential. So if the decline is at a constant rate, you expect big declines when the population is big and small declines when the population is small, never approaching extinction. What brings extinction then is a stochastic process, something that is actually completely random and happens in very small populations where whatever random external environmental factor or some change in some loss in of a specific allele of a gene in the genome of the population brings a decline or the extinction may take a long time after the population has actually been depleted or as some say, even if I don't particularly like the term, have gone functionally extinct. So we tend to have many functionally extinct species that might survive for centuries or even millennia just because of chance.
So we've talked a lot about trends for different areas in the world, trends for island species and mainland species, trends for large and smaller mammals, and also insects, fishes, etc. And we've touched a little bit on the different drivers. If what we've mentioned so and what you've mentioned so far is the pressure through hunting and poaching, there is land use change, so the pressure, the agricultural pressure on habitat. We haven't talked much about climate yet, and certainly there are some other drivers as well. You've mentioned invasive species, especially on islands. How would you rank the different drivers?
That is fairly easy because that is one of the information that is collected by the UCN Red List. So we know from the Red List that habitat loss definitely ranks first, overexploitation ranks second, and then there are the other drivers for now. Then climate change is something that is a bit complicated for a variety of reasons. The first reason is that while it is relatively easy to attribute the deforestation, for example, to a declining population or overexploitation to declining population, it is not so easy to attribute a changing climate that means change in many variables locally, which don't necessarily all go in the same direction and act over a long time because it's not an extreme event. It's easy to attribute something to an extreme climatic event. But if it is a long-term change, then it can trigger long-term changes in populations and the interactions among populations. So there is a lot of modeling on climate, but still a lot of uncertainty. I have to say that the vast majority of the models forecasts that at the current levels of and speed of climate change, it could become the main threat for mammals in a few decades. But I still feel that the uncertainty is very large because we know little of the actual response of each mammal population to change. Some may be able to just cope with the change. Some may be able to track climate. Others might go, but I suspect that for some more time, at least for some more time, there are other more immediate threats that might wipe out populations before climate hits in.
So knowing about the drivers is important also for conservation to help mammals thrive. What are the solutions? What are the most efficient conservation tools that we have?
Here I would divide the problem in two. One is the emergencies. And we know reasonably well what are the best solutions for the emergencies from research that has been done on counterfactual analysis of extinctions prevented and the conservation actions that are associated to those few improvements in conservation status that I was mentioning before. And based on this evidence, it is pretty clear that reintroductions and translocations are important just to escape extinction when numbers are very small, and also captive breeding associated to both reintroduction and translocation. It seems that legislation can be associated to many improvements. Things, for example, of the CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, that regulates trade for many species, and it does so effectively, at least in many countries. But this is all reactive conservation, and it means investing a lot of money in conserving one specific species, and the return can be good, but still it's single species. So the big difference is on indirect drivers. And the big societal changes are those that make a difference. We've seen it in Europe. It was, if you like, a natural experiment because no one decided to leave the countryside because we wanted to save the mammals. But just people decided to move to the cities because there was work in the cities and working in the countryside wasn't economically viable anymore. And this has brought a big change. And all the scenarios that we use to forecast potential effects on mammals, as well as other species, of course, say that changes in how we produce food, how we consume food, changes in diets are those that would have the largest impact. So what we would need to do it would be to leave more space for nature, basically. Design a society that is capable to reduce the overall impact. And for some of the species, we would still need some reactive conservation and interventions, but for many others, like the jackals, like the other large mammals that we've seen expanding in Europe, just leaving space would suffice.
That basically means that we need to produce more food for humans from less land.
Yeah, that is the big challenge. The big challenge is feeding 10 billion people in 2050 and trying to preserve some nature somewhere. And that means probably a mix of intensification of agriculture in some places, maybe novel foods, maybe lab meat, maybe any solution. I don't know any of these solutions. I'm not expert of these solutions in particular, but I think that technology could help a lot.
Yeah, I looked up the numbers before our conversation. 45% of the world's habitable land is agriculture, land used for agriculture. And 80% of that is used for livestock, meat, and dairy. So really changing diets and changing agriculture could spare a lot of land for wilderness and for mammals to come back. Would you agree with that?
Yes, our scenarios also say the same. We made projections based on projections of agricultural production for feeding these 10 billion people in 2050, together with David Tillman. And the single most effective action is probably changing diet, really, and closing the yield gap, together with closing the yield gap that is producing as much as possible where agriculture is carried out. But changing diet would be a crucial element because it would require much less space. I mean, if we feed on agriculture rather than cattle because of thermodynamics,
and the
efficiency of the diet is much higher.
The developed countries have made a lot of progress on that. We grow a lot more food on a hectare, but there are other regions in the world where agriculture is still very inefficient, and then it uses a lot of land that could be spared for wildlife, especially with a growing population. But that's maybe to a different podcast episode. But I think it's very important. And so maybe the last question is already kind of answered. It's not the last one. But one of the last questions is, like, those people listening to this podcast, individuals, what can they do today to help mammals thrive?
So, well, certainly diet is an important one. Less meat doesn't necessarily mean to become all vegetarian, but just a bit less meat in the diet helps all the wild mammals. And then we have an overwhelming impact on the other species. So we have to be very careful, for example, with pets. Domestic cats, keep domestic cats at home. They are a big source of damage for wildlife. They kill millions or billions of small mammals every year. Be careful with other pets that might be alien species, and many invasive alien species have been introduced as pets. Yeah, in general, we need to think of living space and minimizing our and actions to leave space for the rest of nature.
Great. We've touched a lot of very interesting topics during this conversation. Carlo, what would you like the audience to remember from this conversation? What is the most important take-home message from your point of view?
Yeah, well, mammals are not just beautiful. They are beautiful. But they're also an important indicator of nature because they're big. Some of them are very big. And conserving mammals means that we are probably conserving many other species together with them. And the important message is about space. We need to leave space for the mammals.
Thank you very much, Carlo, for this very interesting conversation. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe. Inside Biodiversity is available on all major streaming platforms.